Right, thank you very much, Stephen. As he's said, the ink is barely dry on the draft bill, so this is a sort of quick canter through the main provisions at present, and starting, I think you've got the handout with a little comparison with what we said in our report. I should say that as part of the new approach of the government, the Department of Health, this, I'm told, is the first time they've actually published the bill on a website. So those of you who feel particularly inspired later on today or whenever, you can go on and you can place your comments on any of the individual provisions, and they're very interested to hear from you, they tell me. So, and then I'll just say at the end a bit about the process. As Stephen said, the Law Commission were asked to carry out a project looking at the position with regard to adult social care. For those of you who practice in that area, and I'm sure all of you will have had cases that have touched on it at some time, it is very complex, and there's various judicial statements to that effect. What we suggested was to sweep away all of the existing legislative landscape, replace it with a single statute. The government is not to have any power to issue directions, which they use, in our opinion, rather to profligacy at the moment, and it should all be underpinned by a statutory code of practice, and at its heart there should be the wellbeing principle. In terms of the bill, we've had, as you can see, a great sort of success in general terms. Yes, they've accepted there should be a single statute. We'll come on to that. Yes, they've accepted there should be minimal use of directions. They've said they want to retain the power, but they will use it only in exceptional circumstances if there's some great crisis. And that's why they wanted to retain it. In terms of code of practice, they're saying that our suggestion was too cumbersome. So what they want to do is to operate with a system a bit as like that which operates for the Children Act. So there'll be a sort of suite of documents which have statutory effect. But at the heart, there will be the wellbeing principle. And indeed, that is clause one of the bill as it is now. So, in terms of any decision relating to care and support, the individual well-being has to be at the heart of that decision. How is that to be judged? That is to be judged by reference to the factors that you can see on the screen. So, there is the assumption that the person is going to be the best judge of their well-being, the fact that there may be other circumstances or a certain way of doing things is not to have any weight anymore. So it's a person-centered approach. That means taking on board the person's views, wishes, and feelings, and having regard to their circumstances, and encouraging full participation in decision-making. That, of course, can sometimes be in conflict with, or at least in tension with, the wishes of the carer. How does one resolve that? By taking a holistic view, and also in making a decision, if intervention is required, it is to be to the minimum necessary, and at all times the authority must be aware of protecting an adult from abuse and neglect. I'll come on to deal with safeguarding and what is happening there shortly. After clause one, before we get to the assessing needs part, which is in clause nine, there are a series of clauses which deal with the general duties and powers on behalf of local authorities. And what they say in broad terms is that so far as the local authority is concerned, they are under a statutory duty to provide advice and assistance. The rationale behind that is, of course, part of the prevention agenda. Through providing advice and assistance, it will preclude either the requirement for an assessment on an individual basis, or at least reduce the extent to which there needs to be any public sector involvement. So that's the rationale for that. In addition to that, there are statutory duties of cooperation being suggested between the local authority and its key partners. Now, its key partners can be other authorities, and it's possible for authorities to join together to discharge their services, or it can be the police, or it can be the health service. If the partner authority refuses to cooperate, then they have to set down their reasons in writing. And clearly, if those reasons are irrational, then the usual public law consequences apply. Having been through that part of the bill, there is a clause which deals with assessment of needs. And that, you can see, is set at a low threshold. So where an adult has an appearance of need, there is then a duty on the local authority to assess them. There are provisions which give the local authority the power to delegate, and that can apply to circumstances of assessment. When those circumstances are appropriate for delegation will be set out in regulations. If a person has capacity, then they have the right to refuse an assessment, and if that refusal is given, then the local authority's duty is discharged. But as part of the assessment process, the local authority, consistent with Clause 1, which we've looked at already, has to consult the carer, any other named person in particular who the assessed person wants to be consulted. And so there is a broad duty of consultation envisaged. The details of the community care assessment will be set out in regulations. And I understand, although there's nothing in the white papers, in fact, but it was the position, let's put it this way, before yesterday, that the assessment regulations were to be published in draft in the autumn so that they could be looked at in tandem with the pre-legislative scrutiny in relation to the bill, but we'll wait and see. Right, having been through the assessment process, which I should say is one which is to be proportionate to the individual's needs. So it's important, therefore, that if somebody, for example, has fairly minimal needs, that they don't need an hours-long assessment or reams of paper of the sort that one can see. But having been through that process, there will then be the issue of, is the person concerned eligible for services? There will be a single eligibility framework for all services. And this is the first time, if it makes it through, that will appear on the face of the statute. There will be a duty on the government to set out the framework in regulations, and you will have heard, those of you listening to the news yesterday or seeing Andrew Nansley speak, that as part of, whether it's the councils or increasingly it looks as if it will be the government, setting eligibility criteria, there is envisaged to be a nationally applicable minimum threshold. And that is what the white paper says. Those words did make it in to the draft bill, but marrying the two together, that seems to be the approach that we're going down. And there will be a repeal of Section 21 of the National Assistance Act. Government thinks that with that repeal, there will be nobody falling through the net, which was our concern. And part of our recommendations were that that should be kept. But we'll wait and see. So far as carers are concerned, there is a sort of a radical approach to carers in this way. At present, they can be assessed under four statutes, and various sets of regulations, and they've all got different tests. Carers are now to be placed on the same footing as the cared for person. So there will be a duty to assess the carer, again, who appears to have need for support. They don't have to request an assessment. There is no longer to be any requirement for them to be discharging substantial or regular care. And the eligibility criteria for carer's services will be analogous to that for the cared for person. So the situation with regard to carers, of whom there are at least 5 million, the figure changes, we were saying 6 in our consultation process. Standing Commission for Carers says that's an underestimate, but government says it's 5, so who knows, a large number, is that the situation of entitlement for them should be much clearer. Right, there are then various clauses which deal with financial provision, personal budgets, and direct payments. The provision which has received quite a lot of publicity, which is that it's possible to defer payment until after the person has died through having a charge on their home. And that provision is indeed within the bill. Moving to the situation with regard to safeguarding, though, as you will be aware, this is a contentious area. One of the very first of our recommendations, which the government said it was going to accept, was that there should be statutory adult safeguarding boards. They exist in many cases throughout the country, although not all, but it's the first time they've been put on a statutory footing. Their duties, which include dealing with serious case reviews in relation to an adult, are there set out again on the face of the statute. There will be duties to publish biannual reports, if things remain as they are now, as part of discharging their duties. So this whole area should be more effective, so as to avoid the disasters such as Fiona Pilkington and the like. So there will be a duty on the local authority to inquire in cases of abuse and neglect. So if an adult is at risk of abuse or neglect, then that will cause the duty to kick in. As part of the membership of the safeguarding boards, there are certain bodies that have to be a member, the police and the NHS. There are many others who can be co-opted. So that's adopting precisely our recommendations. What it is thought at the moment is that there may be a gap in the legislative provision, because there are those cases where the person at risk cannot be accessed by the local authority because the carer or another member of the family does not allow the local authority access. So the reference to consultation on safeguarding powers is to a parallel consultation exercise which is going on now, to ask whether there is a need for a supplementary power on the part of a local authority to be able to access the property when there is that person denying access. And see the person concerned. There will not be, and it's not suggested, that there will be a power of removal. Because interestingly, when we went out to consultation on that, there was significant support for going into the property to see the person. And that support fell away dramatically when it came to removing the person concerned. So will wait and see whether, as a result of that consultation exercise, further powers are added in relation to safeguarding. The government is saying in the bill that Section 47 of the National Assistance Act should be repealed. That's the provision which enabled a local authority to remove somebody from their home in sanitary circumstances. Put it that way, but in respect of which there was then no basis for challenge for a period of time, 6 weeks, I think, and clearly that's in conflict with the ECHR, and so our recommendation in relation to that has been accepted. Other key parts of our reforms to sort of counter through, which have made it into the bill. Portable assessments. What the government is proposing there is that if somebody moves from Newcastle, say, to Manchester, they are entitled to take their care package with them until and receive that level of care from Manchester until Manchester themselves carry out the assessment. So there will be no interruption of care, which is what has happened in the concern about the postcode lottery. Transitional services for young people. We were struck in consultation about the numbers of young people, as in 16 or 17, who experience difficulty transitioning into adult social care. So there is a provision in the bill which is to the effect that a young person can request the adult local authority to carry out an assessment in relation to them, which the authority can do if it thinks it's appropriate to do so, and making, therefore, the position easier. And there's also an amendment to the Children Act to make that position easier as well. There are lists of services and outcomes so that it's clear the nature of the provision which is the subject of social care. Having been through the assessment and eligibility testing, which the local authority is under a duty to do, then the person concerned is entitled to a care and support plan. Clearly, if provision is not provided in accordance with that, that is an enforceable right in the way that it is now. Duty to prevent needs for care and support I have dealt with by telling you about the duty for information and so on. There is also to be reform of Section 117 of the Mental Health Act so that in terms of discharge, if the person concerned, for example, expresses a preference as to where they want to go, then that preference is to be met if it's practical to do so. There are the duties to cooperate. Again, I've indicated to you the cast of those. And there's also a further duty, which is to promote integration between social care and healthcare provision. It is hoped that there'll be closer working by the NHS and the local authority in relation to that. And there is, for the first time, a statutory right to a personal budget. So there is a range of reforms, assuming they stay as now, in the draft care and support bill. It's been a very quick canter through, but I wanted to finish early in case there are any questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Francis, for that. Does anyone have any questions?
I do. Yeah. The use of the expression well-being.
Yes.
So, really, was that recognition of the commission?
Yes.
That the government has taken? What was the rationale behind using that expression as opposed to best interests, for example?
Well, best interest has got a particular meaning in the context of mental capacity. And so we didn't think that was the, I mean, I can see, you can say, what, you know, is this a semantic difference, actually?
Well, yes.
Yes. but we wanted to distance ourselves from mental capacity. That, I mean, obviously there is an interrelationship between social care and mental capacity, but we thought that well-being enshrined what we wanted to attain in our final report better than best interests, and that has remained at present in the draft bill.
Sorry, can I ask you a question? You mentioned that it may preclude an assessment if they comply with an advice or an assistance duty. So is that a situation where the authority can say, well, we're not going to carry out an assessment because we think we've done everything we can or need to do?
No, no, there's a general duty. So there's a universal duty to provide advice and assistance, and then there's a personal duty to carry out an assessment. The local authority is under a duty to carry that out if there is an appearance of need. That duty can be discharged if the person concerned, having mental capacity, refuses the assessment. Obviously, if they haven't got mental capacity, different position. But that would be the only basis upon which the duty would be discharged, in the sense that the local authority didn't have to go on to the next step.
That's reassuring because I was concerned, because in homelessness, for example, they often try and use their advice and assistance duties as a means of escaping their actual statutory duties from the interest. The other question I just want to ask you is, in relation to the assessment of need, does the bill intend to dispose of ex-party barren?
The bill obviously doesn't condescend to that degree of detail. I think it's universally acknowledged, using Jane Austen's phrase, but in a different context, that there will be a case which will challenge the Barry decision, but that has not happened yet. The bill itself does not take that issue, which is clearly a live one in the field, further.
Which I see. I mean, the problem is there have been cases, haven't there? And then, of course, it's got to the Supreme Court and suddenly it's found it doesn't actually arise in front of it.
Yes.
So I just wonder whether this might actually be a useful opportunity to get to part of that.
Well, it may well be that 4 or 5 years down the track, when this, assuming it is an act then, that that issue will arise, but under the Care and Support Act, as it will then be. But in itself, it doesn't take that issue any further.
Anyone else? Yes, in back.
But is there any protection for people who are with authorities who provide, say, a substantial need for a critical need? If government sets the threshold of critical, which is more than likely, are those people going to be protected or going to be receiving on the basis of substantial need?
The bill itself, not surprisingly, doesn't, as currently passed, does not deal with that position, because most local authorities provide just critical needs in any event. So the short answer to your question is, there's nothing in the bill at present which deals with that position. That, of course, doesn't stop you, as I say, making representations online as to whether it should. I think that it's envisaged from reading of the white paper in conjunction with the bill that there will be national eligibility criteria, and how the government approaches those. I think one just has to see how it all sort of plays out. So I can't give you a black and white answer to your question, I'm afraid. That's the best that I can do.
Thank you. Anyone else? Your question you want to ask? Yes, in the front, yes.
Just a little supplementary to that and also Rory's question about well-being. Do you think that the draft bill that you've been involved in intends, through the concept of well-being, to make any kind of change in the balance of tension between subjectively expressed want and objectively assessed best interest need, or is it simply your intention to reflect the status quo?
No, our intention was to put the person at the heart of the new legislative framework, and consistent with that, is the duty of well-being, as I say, supported by the various factors, which assumes that they are the best judge of what they need. And in conjunction with that, therefore, so far as the assessment of need is concerned, that will be more subjective. I mean, I'm not saying it's a radical change, but there will be a slight change in the existing balance. Well, that's what we imagined would happen. When it comes to the assessment of eligibility and meeting the need, however, so in other words, once you've assessed what it is, then you're going to have the same objective approach, yes. Yeah. So there will still be a balancing act to be discharged.
Well, I think we've got to 1 o'clock, so unless anyone's got anything burning they want to ask now, then I'll just ask to say thank you to Francis.